It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A grant from the State Health Department enables UW Green Bay to launch the Wisconsin Caregiver Academy. Wisconsin seeks to train 10,000 people as certified direct care professionals in a free program to address a caregiver shortage. Be part of this discussion, calling in with a question or comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kevin Coughlin is a policy initiative advisor in the Division of Medicaid Services at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Kevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be here.
Good morning. And Jamie Kuhn here, director of this Division of Medicaid Services at the agency. Jamie, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Jamie, let's start with you. The state health figures cite a need for 20,000 more professional caregivers by next year. Why set a goal of training 10,000 people as certified direct care professionals?
Well, Kate, thanks for having me. I think just a little context. I think just want to make sure that listeners understand that, you know, Governor Tony Evers, back when he took office, created a governor's task force on caregiving because he understood, as we all do, the importance of this profession, the importance of making sure that Wisconsin residents and families have access to the care they need in their home and in their community. And so as we all understand, the industry, the workforce is a hugely important issue right now. We are able to utilize and work towards innovative solutions to make sure that we are continuing to support our direct caregivers who, as you know, really are the backbone of our communities and making sure that our families have what they need so they can stay in their community and in their homes. And so, you know, we have to set a goal and we want to try to train as many individuals as we can. If we exceed that goal, that also would be equally exciting. But we also know, again, that if we're going to make sure our residents stay healthy and safe, that we are going to need to support our caregivers who, again, are working directly with our families in the community.
Kevin, Wisconsin, this Jamie leads into it, has this new online program then to boost the caregiver workforce. How does this free training program work?
Yeah, so it's going to be all fully accessible via online learning. And we've done our partners, University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, has really done a great job of putting together a curriculum that will give the individual the really broad skills to be able to work with a lot of different people with disabilities or our elderly individuals, to keep them, you know, really living their best life in their own homes and their community. So it's 14 different competencies that they'll learn. And the nice part is that with it being online, anybody in the state will have access to it. And it's on demand so that they can do it at their own pace. They can, you know, if it's going to take a little bit longer, you know, that's fine. We're just there to help support them through this education journey of theirs. And then, you know, once they complete it, they take a proctored online virtual exam and they then go on our registry.
What comes up for me, though, is that caregiving, it's deeply personal, direct care. I mean, it's human to human. Can a digital certification training program, can that adequately prepare people for a real hands-on environment?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, we did a lot of research on this, and we've learned a lot during the pandemic, and especially the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. You know, they're really experts in curriculum development and getting training out to individuals. And they've put in place a lot of different techniques to make it more of a almost one-on-one experience as they're taking their training. But this is not, this training is not like everything that they're going to need. Mm-hmm. You know, the providers and agencies that they work for are also going to have to, you know, provide additional support and training. And then we have another part of our scope of work where we're, our certification will be linking to other micro-credentials. And those micro credentials might be additionally training that will get a little bit more in depth on the skills that they need as they're out in those community placements.
Kevin Coughlin with us, Policy Initiative Advisor in the Division of Medicaid Services. Jamie Kuhn is here, Director of the Division at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, as we look more deeply at the caregiver workforce and how to add more people to it. You can join in 800-642-1234 by asking a question, sharing comments. Let's go to Tiffany in Nakusa. Tiffany, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a CNA about 10 years ago, and it was a super rewarding job. I worked at a long-term care facility that also worked with rehab patients after surgeries and really enjoyed the job, but it was a super difficult job, very challenging. And as the for-profit ownership took over and stuff, it got more and more challenging trying to meet the needs of more patients. And honestly, the pay just wasn't enough to take care of my family, so I ended up cross-training into ultrasound because it just paid better. And I think long-term, I saw a lot of people doing that over the years, just cross-training out to find something else that paid better for the amount of effort that they were putting into. So I wonder if maybe we just need to have a cultural shift into just seeing about increasing the pay for that type of position.
Tiffany, thank you for sharing your personal story about being a CNA. Jamie, very rewarding, but at the end of the day, the salary couldn't provide for Tiffany's family. What are your insights there?
Yeah, thank you, Tiffany. Really, really appreciate you sharing that. I mean, we absolutely agree that, and this is one step in that process, right? We want to make sure that workers, direct care workers, have the professional supports that they need, so they actually can also gain credentials that ideally would lead to additional pay. And I think we also have been working with Governor Tony Evers to make sure that we are continuing to push measures that would increase pay for direct care workers. Really directly to Tiffany's point, that these are individuals who are compassionate, hardworking people who care about the community and are doing this work because they really do want to support our family members, and we believe that they should be valued, and that includes through pay that is commensurate with the work that they are doing.
Kevin, the new online certification program, it does include a $500 bonus for people who become certified, stay employed for 6 months. Are bonuses currently incentivizing people to sign up?
Yeah, we think so. You know, our program just started middle of July, so we've already have over 2,000 individuals that have signed up, and they're ready to start their new career. So we, in the program that we were in, similar to this, back in 2018, where we were a very similar project to get people into CNAs and to work in nursing homes, we had a similar bonus program. And what we've heard from many caregivers is that you know, it wasn't everything. It wasn't the main thing that got them there, but it was very, it was a big thing for them. You know, $500 that they didn't have before that, that they could use for themselves or to help their family. And we felt it strongly that that was a good incentive to get people at least to think about it and to try this career.
Kevin Coughlin is Policy Initiative Advisor in the Division of Medicaid Services at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Jamie Kuhn, Director of the Division at the agency, as we explore the need for caregivers in our state. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Health Department cites one in four direct caregiver positions is vacant. We check in on efforts to train thousands of people to become certified direct care workers through free training. Call in with a question, share a perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kevin Coughlin is a policy initiative advisor in the Division of Medicaid Services at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and Jamie Kuhn is director of that division. Jamie, 88% of Americans prefer at-home assistance over nursing homes. That is according to a survey in 2021 by the Associated Press and the Center for Public Affairs Research. Is demand for at-home caregivers growing here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think unequivocally, yes. We are, and as the population continues to age, we know that this is an important priority for individuals in Wisconsin and across the country. And we are working really hard on many, many initiatives related to providing services for individuals in their home and in their community. And it will continue to grow, and we will continue to need to be innovative in this space. And we are very fortunate that we were able to use American Rescue Plan dollars to support a number of initiatives in this space where we are working to support people through home and community-based services. And this program also is not just for individuals who are receiving that care through Medicaid, but also in the private sector. So we are collaborating with many partners, and that's what it's gonna take as we see an increase in the need. We're gonna continue to need to collaborate, and that this program is really the epitome of how collaboration can work throughout the state to ensure that we are recruiting more individuals to care for our family members.
Kevin, students who are certified through the online program can automatically join the Certified Direct Care Professional Registry. How does this connection benefit employers who need these workers?
Yeah, so part of this project is also to what we created was a IT portal called WISC Caregiver Connections. And it's a way that both our certified direct care professionals and our employers, the agencies and providers that are out there, can connect together. So each of them joins the portal, and they can find each other. And then we also are going to have additional resources to help support the certified direct care professionals in their career path, and then also support providers to, I think it's important that we have a culture of that really thrives on supporting the caregivers once they're there. You know, we can get them trained and we can get them in their door, but it's really the providers and the agencies that have to, create an environment where people really want to work there and they want to, take care of the people in our state. So
retention is so key because, otherwise this pipeline, you continually have to bring more people in. And, we've been watching the WISC Caregiver Careers Program as it's evolving in these years, trying to meet these challenges in healthcare staffing. I just wonder, Kevin, how effective is this type of program model to address the workforce shortage of caregivers?
Well, we're seeing it as a very successful model, and I think other states are looking at Wisconsin. I was recently at a national conference for home and community-based services, and we were featured on three different panels because of some of the innovation that we're doing here in Wisconsin related to the workforce, because, kind of everybody's scratching their head trying to figure out what do we do. And I think, we're really taking a comprehensive approach to this. As Jamie indicated, we have lots of partners that we're working with. We're working with the Department of Public Instruction and the Department of Workforce Development with youth apprenticeship programs and career pathways for young high school kids to think about this as a career.
I wonder, Jamie, another component you mentioned with the federal funding from ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act, is funding this new state program to help people live at home independently. It's a pilot program, the Independent Living Pilot Program. How is this initiative supporting seniors?
Yeah, great question. Thank you. We are through the independent living support pilot, we are providing resources for individuals to through the assistance of our local ADRCs. And we are working to ensure that they have resources so they can fulfill some needs to stay in their home. So whether it is specialized medical equipment, assistive technology, home and vehicle modifications, we are allowing individuals to receive resources through this funding. And we are analyzing very closely what those needs are and how we're filling the gap. And we believe that this will be a really successful program that people will want to continue because, again, it really highlights the need for people that with some support, they are able to stay in their homes and live in their community, which, as you said earlier, is really what individuals are looking for.
And so this program partners with local aging and disability resource centers.
Yes, sorry,
No,
correct.
that's okay. We're talking about training caregivers and growing Wisconsin's caregiver workforce. We have Jamie Kuhn and Kevin Coughlin with the State Health Department. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We touched on this just a bit earlier, but I want to kind of circle back here because Vicki from Wausau called in, and Vicki is really concerned about a hands-on component of the caregiver training program through an online program and is wondering about, you know, where does the hands-on component happen? Jamie is, or Kevin, can you field that?
Yeah, so we have there are a number of videos that individuals take that show some of that hands-on experience that a caregiver will need in their work. But we also then are expecting the providers to, you know, it's kind of a handoff to the providers when they get the job to really have more of that one-on-one, hands-on experience and examples of what's needed. Because really, it's hard to do a training that will meet everybody's needs. You know, there's so many people that have individual needs in the community, and that's really the expectation is the provider and the agency need to do that one-on-one, you know, what care is needed for the individuals that they'll be taking care of. But we do feel strongly that they're going to have some very good kind of universal worker skills and abilities when they've completed this certification. And then again, we're going to have some of these micro credentials, and some of those might be actual in-person training that individuals will receive, and they'll have those additional credentials on their resume.
Jamie, turning to the family care program, the Medicaid long-term care program getting $89 million this summer, and funds will raise wages for both personal care workers and direct care workers. What do you hope this effort accomplishes?
Yeah, I think just to everyone's earlier points, as you know, we know that these the work that these individuals do, direct care providers do, is invaluable. And we agree that they should be able to make a living and provide this compassionate, intimate service that, as we know, the need is just going to increase. So we hope that it will show anyone that is interested and those who are in the profession that there are the administration is supportive of the work they do, and we will continue to work hard to address their wages and value that work.
Kevin, what is the message for state lawmakers in advocating for caregivers?
Well, I think, you know, we have so many people that depend on these caregivers. And, you know, I think one of the things I'm most proud of in this process is creating a certified direct care professional and getting the word professional into that title because of the importance of their work and the value that we need to have. And I think this is a topic that, you know, everybody understands. We have to have caregivers across our state to keep people in their homes, in their community. So I think we've seen a lot of interest, kind of across the aisle. Everybody has an interest in trying to help this workforce. So we're hopeful. We think that we're going to have a lot of data and information that we can give to lawmakers to help them make good decisions on the future of this program.
Jamie and Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you,
It's an
Kate.
honor to be here.
Jamie Kuhn, Director of the Division of Medicaid Services at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and Kevin Coughlin is a Policy Initiative Advisor in that same division. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an excerpt from the new podcast, Humanity Unlocked, which is focusing on people impacted by the justice system in Wisconsin.
Tattoos can tell the story of a person's life. They feature aesthetic beauty, inside jokes, or family memories. Some of Daniel Schleicher's tattoos memorialize his favorite people. His story comes to us from the Odyssey Beyond Bars project, which provides classes for students incarcerated in Wisconsin.
I'm a little nervous, I ain't gonna lie to y'all. But bear with me. All right, so my story's called Penguins, Bears, and Tattoos All Mine. When I was a kid, I looked up to Kenny. I wished he was my dad. He wasn't. Kenny was, in fact, my two older sisters' dad. I remember him coming over to our house to pick up my sisters for his weekend to have them. I never understood why I couldn't go with them. It was clear I was a likable kid, how he played basketball with me while waiting for them to get ready, which felt like forever. Yet it was probably just minutes. In those moments of shooting hoops, I would even pretend he was my dad, but Kenny wasn't my dad. He wasn't my stepdad. He was, however, a father figure, and I honor him today in calling him my bonus dad. I only wish I could have told him this, for those moments spent with him meant a lot to me. You see, Kenny passed away in 1994, and what he doesn't know is he played such an important part of my life and had a role in my love for tattoos. He had several himself, and the only one I remember was a tattoo of a penguin on his hand. So to a boy looking up to this man, I just thought this was what men do, is get tattoos. I got my first tattoo at the age of 13 in a friend's garage. It was a nickname friends called me back then, and it was difficult to hide from my mother. And now that I'm older, several tattoos later, it's still getting difficult to hide them from my mother. I never had a scheme to my madness of tattoos other than if I wanted something somewhere, I got it. I'm tattooed literally head to toe. I can't say I have a favorite. I have some I want to cover and many more I want to get. I do, however, have some that got me through some dark times with just a glance, like my children's names on my fingers that I see every moment of the day. There's my mother's name on my arm, as she's been the strength and my unconditional love. I have my granddaughter's handprint over my heart because she's a piece of my heart in human form. And I have my last name, Schleicher, which is Kenny's last name, that I carry on for him. I also have a rose tattoo for him with Rest in Peace Kenneth and the date he passed. And yet my mind comes back to that penguin tattoo. That tattoo created a love for penguins that runs so deep. I customized my own penguin stuffed animals for my kids and granddaughter when I was in Columbia Correctional Institute. I used to work for the Incel Teddy Bear Project, and that's where I had the opportunity to do so. I've drawn cards and pictures of penguins for them. And when I did beadwork, I made those tiny penguins that fit on the tops of pens, and their little arms would flop all upside down with each pen stroke. That's not where my love stops. I had penguins looked up to discover that they only mate once in their lifetime, and on an occasion, if the mate dies, they will move on. The male even goes as far to find a pebble or a rock, like a diamond, that he kicks around until he presents it to the female. If that is not a true love story for you, then I don't know what is. I decided I'd like to get a penguin tattoo in memory of Kenny. I wanted the exact tattoo or close to, so I wrote home asking for photos of these in order to draw it. That's when I discovered my whole life was a lie, that Kenny did not have a penguin tattoo on his hand, like I remembered. He had, in fact, a bear tattoo. And not just any bear, but the Ham's bear from Ham's Beer. Okay, in all fairness, this was over 30 years ago, and I only had minutes with the man, and the ink back then was good, was not a good quality. So this tattoo was mistaken as a penguin. You can see it. Yeah. Now you know how I feel. Now I have to get this Hans Bear tattooed in memory of Kenneth Schleicher, and I still want to get a penguin tattooed for the moments he shared and what that meant to a boy just wanting a father, something I never got to tell him. Thank you.
That story about tattoos came from Daniel Schleicher while he was incarcerated in Oregon, Wisconsin. His story is featured in the newest season of the Human Powered podcast, Humanity Unlocked, which is focusing on people impacted by the justice system in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Heat from the Earth's core could help eliminate carbon pollution through geothermal power. And new technologies used in oil and gas drilling could be a breakthrough for renewable energy. Mike in Madison is asking us to explore the potential here in Wisconsin for geothermal exchange systems. And you can call in with a question or share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Yufeng Lin is Principal Research Hydrologist for the Illinois State Geological Survey. Yufeng, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much, Kay. Happy to be here.
Yes, there is some breakthrough in drilling by fracturing rock to expand the areas where geothermal energy and heating are possible. How is geothermal technology changing?
Well, actually, geothermal energy is a very broad term. And based on the Department of Energy's report, actually, there are about 11 different applications in our country which are feasible. And then to use the hot geothermal energy to generate the power, it's just one of the 11. And some people say it's for everywhere because, I mean, no matter where you are on Earth, you all reach the core. It's just a matter of the distance, how deep you got to go, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but the challenge is how deep you need to go to that temperature, and do we have the physical drilling technology available or not?
Do we have the ability to drill that far in order to get to that type of heat temperature? And that is where I think that we're seeing some technological breakthroughs. Is that right?
Yeah, that's just one of the aspects of using geothermal resources. I like to say resources. It doesn't necessarily need to be power generation. So in our country here, West Coast, East Coast, they do have some area and which is very favorable because their heat source is very much closer to surface than Midwest area. In Midwest area, we got to really go very deep, and which might not be feasible for the current technology with reasonable cost.
But you also say that the Midwest is a sweet spot for geothermal heat exchange. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. And so geothermal heat exchange, which is different than using geothermal for the power generation. So basically, we are using almost constant temperature in the subsurface and to do the heat exchange. So for example, let's say in Wisconsin, you have, like say, that summer 90 degree, winter minus 10, and the whole year long, you try to use energy to convert this 100 degree difference into your comfort zone. Let's say, Kate, in your house, let's say 70 degree.
Mm-hmm.
You are using the energy, try to convert that 100 degree range into 70 all year long. But think about in Wisconsin, I think it's about 55 degree in the subsurface. So somehow it can exchange your heat, the need you heat from outside, and then make it 55 degree and then bring it up to your room. And you only need to adjust 15 degrees. And that's why you save a lot of energy on that. So it's not really using a geothermal as the source to produce electricity. but it can use for your indoor heating and cooling.
And,
and that's the idea.
Yes, and these exchange systems, they can be like a direct exchange. They can be like a closed loop system. There are different systems in exchange. Can you give us a little bit of a primer on what that means in these systems to get to underneath to you know access the geothermal exchange system?
Yes. So you correct. And there are many different options for using geothermal exchange method for indoor heating and cooling. And some of them use for like a greenhouse, for industrial usage. And so you mentioned some very technical term, closed loop and open loop.
Mm-hmm.
And that depends on how you transfer the heat using the liquid inside your pipe system. So closed loop, which means that you have the liquid inside the pipe and you never go out of the loop. And so you won't have any exchange with subsurface material or your groundwater system. Open loop is, as you say, open. So it could extract the groundwater and then using the groundwater as exchange media and then put it back to aquifer system on that. So those are two of the many examples we can use. And then such as some of the work we are doing with US Geological Survey, we call it underground thermal storage. So basically you subsurface to store heat or cool. So you can have more heat to use during the winter time and you have more cool to use during the summertime.
In terms of groundwater sources and aquifers, the New York Times reports many American regions are using groundwater sources faster than they're able to naturally replenish. How could mm-hmm. depleting groundwater affect geothermal exchange?
And actually, it could. And so in the groundwater system in the Midwest area, which is one of the reasons I call we are on a hot spot here, because if your subsurface is saturated with groundwater or is dry, that could change the geothermal exchange efficiency more than 10 times. Mm. So that's why in the Midwest area, like Wisconsin, like Illinois, like Minnesota, we have very abundant groundwater system, and which give us really this advantage to have a very favorable geological condition to do the geothermal exchange. So when the groundwater depleted, and that efficiency is going to be decreased.
Yufeng Lin is Principal Research Hydrologist at the Illinois State Geological Survey. Our guide to how geothermal systems are in use, geothermal exchange here in Wisconsin. You can be part of the discussion, calling in with a question, sharing a comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A renewable energy effort is underway to unlock vast amounts of geothermal energy from Earth's crust. And we learn about the viability of geothermal systems as a renewable power source in Wisconsin. Call in with the question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Yufeng Lin is Principal Research Hydrologist at the Illinois State Geological Survey. Yufeng, Epic Systems here in Dane County has one of the largest geothermal exchange systems in the Midwest. What can you tell us about their facilities?
Oh, Epic System is very well known in our field. And as a hydrogeologist, I got a privilege to work with some scientists in Wisconsin from the Wisconsin State Survey and also UW Madison. So they took me to the Epic and to visit their facility. And you can see, I mean, the Epic is a world-class company. And then their work needs a lot of indoor heating and cooling, and then their data center also need a cooling capacity.
Oh, they have so many servers in their data areas that need cooling, I would imagine.
That definitely is one of the function of their work on that. And so by using geothermal exchange system, that really saved them a lot of electricity usage for that. And last time I visited, they had more than 7,000 boreholes. And borehole, which means using a closed loop and to use that loop, that borehole as an exchanger, and to reduce their electricity usage of that.
So drilling 7,000 boreholes, and that is one company. I mean, if we scale up in a big way, could all that drilling for geothermal exchange systems, could that cause tremors?
Yeah, so right now for the geothermal exchange system, drilling is the majority of the cost. So that's why our team here, and we also work with Wisconsin Geological Survey. Dave Hart is our main contact scientist, and Jim Tengen from UW Madison. We have been working on to understand subsurface better, and so in order to eliminate unnecessary drilling cost. So, for example, in out in Illinois, University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana campus, we recently have a new building called Campus Instructional Facility, and original design to use geothermal. They need 80 bore. I'm sorry, they need 60 boreholes in the original design. And then after we use our study to pinpoint exactly what's the material in the subsurface, and then the groundwater flow, groundwater depths, and then they will be able to cut down from 60 borehole to 40 boreholes. So the payback year for the system original was 40 years, and then they cut down to 28 years. And that system saved University of Illinois about $45,000 on heating and cooling every year.
Wow. Let's take a call. Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. My understanding is that vertical wells are an option for a closed loop system in a residential situation. If a larger home has three heating systems, three furnaces, three air conditioners, is it possible to have a set of vertical wells and have a closed loop system that services all three of those heating systems?
Jeff, thank you for your call, and definitely. And so that's why right now the geothermal system installation company, they will take a look and the size of your house you need, and then they will help you to determine how many boreholes you need. But in the residential area, the challenge usually is not how many boreholes or how many heat pump you need. The challenge usually is the regulation, because when you drill boreholes and in different state, they have different regulation on how far you need to be. Let's say how far of your borehole need to be from your piping system or your septic system or your sewage system on that. So a lot of residential installation is limited by your subsurface, your utility infrastructure.
Yes, along those lines, Wisconsin's DNR says you need a drilling permit to build heat exchange systems in our state. How do states handle regulations around drilling on your residential property?
That's a very good question, Kate. So every state has different regulation on that. So, for example, in Illinois, we are regulated by public health, and so New York, they have a very different regulation on that. So that's my short answer. Every state is different.
Yufeng Lin is principal research hydrologist at the Illinois State Geological Survey as we look at the potential for geothermal power and how geothermal exchange systems work. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. How practical is installing geothermal exchange systems for residential homes today, Yufeng?
Well, it's not that difficult. So basically, the technology for the residential installation is very similar as drilling your the water wells. Mm-hmm. So actually, a lot of geothermal drillers are the same drillers from water wells, although different states might require different license. And usually, the water well driller probably has more requirement than the geothermal driller, because if you want to drill groundwater and for drinking, and that definitely need to be regulated even more.
The 2022 Inflation Reduction Act has clean energy credits that could cover up to 30% of the cost of installing geothermal systems. How impactful is that tax credit?
And I think that's very helpful for people to understand this is a good options for the indoor heating and cooling. Because again, as I mentioned earlier, the majority of the installation cost is on the drilling, and then it's the front end cost. And that's why if you own a system with significant time, let's say 10 years, you probably already got your money back. So that's why a lot of people don't want to invest, because of the front cost is much higher, although the maintenance and later cost on using electricity, everything else is much, much lower. So that creative difference will help people, increase people's incentive to do this.
Yufeng, in our final minute together, how does geothermal fit into our country's transition to cleaner energy compared to other projects like solar and wind power?
Well, in my point of view, I might have bias because I do research on this, but I do believe it is a very, very feasible solution for us, because, I mean, we are using Earth as our heating and cooling buffer, and which is the basically unlimited resource for us.
And could these exchange systems provide 100% of, say, a home's heating and cooling needs?
And that depends on the area, uh-huh, and also the need. And that's why I say the Midwest is really a sweet spot for us to do this, because we have a very favorable weather pattern, geology, and also our usage of day. So for example, we have hot summer, cold winter, mm-hmm, and which geothermal system, we can even during the summertime when we do this, we increase the subsurface a little bit more, so we can have higher temperature to start during the winter time, mm-hmm, and vice versa. And then our weather pattern, we have some cold summer, we have hot summer and cold winter too.
Yufeng, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yufeng Lin is Principal Research Hydrologist for the Illinois State Geological Survey. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.